This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah. وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories: Iran's foreign minister condemns the latest terrorist attacks in Afghanistan and expresses concern about the rise of Daesh and other Takfiri terror groups in the country. Syria says Israel's killing of a former member of its parliament near the occupied Golan Heights was a cowardly criminal act. Plus, Venezuela is outraged at the extradition to the U.S. of a close aid to President Maduro, with the government saying it will not attend weekend talks with the opposition. Welcome to the program. Our top story: Iran's foreign minister has expressed concern about the rise of Daesh and other Takfiri groups in Afghanistan. Hossein Amiratullahian made the remark during a meeting with Peter Lonsky, Austria's Secretary General for Foreign Affairs and the Federal Ministry for European and International Affairs. Iran's top diplomat called on the European Union to adopt a more responsible approach toward the rights of displaced Afghan people. The Austrian official condemned the latest terror attack in Afghanistan, adding that Tehran and Vienna have shared concerns about Daesh in the Central Asian country. Tens of Afghans have been killed and many others injured after three blasts rocked a Shia mosque in Afghanistan's southern city of Kandahar. The blasts came just weeks, or 1 week that is, after a terrorist attack on Shia worshippers in the northern city of Kunduz left at least 50 people dead. Our correspondent Rahmatullah Baghban has more from Kabul.
Kandahar mosque blast was the deadliest incident since the U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan in August. It was the second week in a row that a Shia mosque came under an attack claimed by a Daesh terrorist group.
I think Daesh attacks must be considered as crimes against humanity. They kill hundreds without being held accountable. The perpetrators are Takfiri terrorist groups and the enemies of Afghanistan and Islam. Taliban, as a new ruler, should maintain security, not only for their officials, but also for citizens.
The recent bomb attacks that targeted our innocent people have no place in Islam. They are misusing Islam's name. The government should take decisive measures and bring those responsible to justice.
Observers see the attacks as part of a larger plot to sow seditions between Muslim brothers in Afghanistan. They add that there are hands-off intelligence agencies and countries behind these divisive plots.
Being defeated in Iraq and Syria, The Daesh terrorist group is taking revenge on Afghan Shias. Also, the US is seeking revenge for its defeat in Afghanistan.
Kandahar attacks comes in line of a series of attacks targeting the unity of Afghan Muslims. Moreover, the most important point about these attacks is that the US is trying to create tensions in the region to involve Iran, India and Russia in an unwanted war.
The Afghanistan Shia Clerics Council condemned the attack and urged the Taliban government to take action against Daesh and fulfill their promises. Shia clerics called for further unity and solidarity among all Muslims.
The recent daily bomb blasts have caused a wave of shock among Afghans, especially in big cities. Many here say they now expect the Taliban to put an end to the terror attacks by Daesh and establish security in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Israeli forces have assassinated a former Syrian parliament member who had spent years in the regime's jails. According to Syrian media, Mehtat As-Saleh was killed in the village of Ain Attina when Israeli snipers targeted him on his way home. Syrian villages near the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights, the Syrian government condemned the killing as, quote, a cowardly criminal act. It said Saleh had spent 12 years in prison in Israel. He was jailed in 1985 for what Tel Aviv called resistance to Israeli authorities. Iraq's Electoral Commission says the turnout in the country's parliamentary election held last Sunday was 43%. The commission said more than 9.6 million people cast their ballots in October the 10th vote. The figure is lower than the last voting that took place in 2018. The party, led by influential cleric Muqtada Sadr, came first and won 73 seats. Several Iraqi factions, including the Fatah Alliance, dismissed the results as fabricated. A total of 329 seats were up for grabs in the election. More than 3,240 candidates were vying for the seats. To our third headline story, Venezuela's negotiations with the opposition is heading for a possible deadlock, with the government now saying that it will not attend the weekend talks in Mexico. Well, that came in reaction to Cape Verde extraditing a close aide to President Nicolas Maduro to the U.S. Caracas accuses Washington of kidnapping diplomatic envoys and says the suspension is in protest against the brutal aggression against the delegate, or its delegate. The government has been holding negotiations with the opposition to resolve a long-running political crisis. Alex Saab was appointed a member of that negotiating team, but he was detained in Cape Verde in 2020 on a U.S. arrest warrant. Saab blames political motives for the money laundering charges against him. France's Yellow Vest anti-government protest group is back on the street for the first time since the coronavirus pandemic. The extremely violent state-sponsored repression of them in 2019 provoked international outrage, but Yellow Vests say they are back on the streets until at least the presidential election in April. Ramin Mazahiri reports from Paris.
France's most repressed political group, the Yellow Vests, have just premiered what they are calling Season 2. In some 300 cities and towns, they have planned to demonstrate in mass numbers for the first time in more than 1.5 years due to the coronavirus restrictions. 3 years ago, the Yellow Vests first donned the reflective protective gear required in French cars to protest regressive gas tax hikes amid record petrol prices. This week, energy costs hit all-time highs in multiple areas.
After 3 years, nothing has changed, except for the fact that things have gotten even worse for the average French person. Life has gotten so much more expensive, but Macron doesn't even care. He doesn't see the demands of the Yellow Vests, or even the French people, as worthy of his attention.
The Yellow Vests were not only the biggest essentially class-based political movement in the Western 21st century, but they were also incredibly popular. 30 other countries started their own Yellow Vest movements. French polls showed them consistently around a 60% approval rating, and that's despite a constant mainstream media campaign against them. They were falsely smeared with charges of xenophobia, but they held marches against anti-Semitism, while their Paris demonstration was led by a banner of a Muslim woman wearing a hijab. President Emmanuel Macron's hardline policy against them provoked international condemnation.
From November 2018 until June 2019, nearly every Saturday in Paris was a scene of massive state repression. The world was shocked by French-style democracy, which uses indiscriminate tear gassings, rubber bullets, and violence against unarmed protesters while still claiming to be a beacon of political and human rights.
We were so numerous in the beginning, but when people began to see how violent and ferocious the government repressed the Yellow Vests, then many got too scared to protest. The government did everything they could to make us disappear, just so they can govern us according to their selfish whims.
The Yellow Vests' list of major demands are basically a call for an entire rethink of French politics, with everything from leaving the European Union, Eurozone, and NATO, to redistribution of France's enormous wealth, to green energy requiring open public debates and referendums. The Yellow Vests say they'll keep marching in the Saturdays to come, which may prove decisive during the presidential election in April. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Now, a piece of advice from Algeria's president for French leaders. Paris must put aside any colonialist thought when dealing with historical issues related to his country. In a message marking the 1961 killings of Algerian protesters by Paris police, Abdelmadjid Tebboune said that historical issues should be treated with a sense of responsibility. He says massacres and crimes against humanity will remain in collective memory. Emmanuel Macron has become the first French president to recognize the crimes committed that day without, however, offering a formal apology. Some anti-racism groups are welcoming Macron's stance, but say it is not enough. Back in October of 1961, Algerians in Paris organized a march against the night curfew. Hundreds are believed to have lost their lives after French police turned on the demonstrators. Protests in Sudan. Thousands have taken to the streets of the capital, demanding the resignation of the transitional government. Protesters accuse the transitional government of failing to improve the economic and political situation in Sudan. They voiced support for the army and called for the military to seize power. Sudan's military and civilian groups have been sharing power in an alliance since President Omar al-Bashir was toppled in 2019. Military leaders have called for political reforms following a failed coup attempt in September attributed to Bashir's loyalists. Civilian leaders have accused the military officials of aiming for a power grab. Pro-civilian groups have planned protests next week. Political commentator Abba Yomi Azakiwa says Sudanese people are discontent at the lack of improvement in the country's economic situation.
Well, the conditions that precipitated the coup against Omar al-Bashir in April of 2019 was the declining economic situation in the Republic of Sudan. There have been demonstrations for about 5 months, and then the army stepped in and took power. Now, the civilian groups, civil society organizations, opposition political parties wanted a civilian interim government. There was a compromise reached later on in 2019 which created the Transitional Sovereign Council. But the chair of the council is the General al-Burhan. Now, it appears as if supporters of the military staged the demonstration that occurred earlier today. Yet, as you mentioned, those who oppose military leadership are scheduled to have their demonstration this coming Thursday. So there's a discontent over the lack of progress in regard to improving the economy in Sudan, and also the confusion around both the domestic as well as foreign policies of that country.
Violence is surging in Indian-controlled Kashmir. Six people have died in shootings as well as clashes between government forces and pro-independence fighters. The clashes left two forces and two fighters dead. A street vendor and a laborer also died in separate shootings that police blamed on pro-independence fighters. Latest deaths bring to 28 the number of people killed in Indian Kashmir over the past 2 weeks. Civilians are among those killed. Muslim-majority region has been seeking independence from India for decades now.
Tensions have mounted since August 2019 when the Indian government annulled Kashmir's semi-autonomy and put it under direct New Delhi rule. Our own Shahnabad earlier joined us from Indian-controlled Kashmir. She gave us details about the latest wave of violence in the disputed region.
Since the beginning of October, things in Kashmir are not going the way they used to be. There have been more than 10 civilians who have died in shooting incidents across the region and in different areas of the Indian-ruled Kashmir. These people have died, cutting across religious lines. There are people from Hindu religion, there are people Muslim, there are Sikhs. So there have been overall 10 people, and today also in separate shooting incidents in Srinagar district and Pulwama, there have been shooting incidents in which two people, one street vendor and a laborer, were killed. They were non-locals, they were not from Kashmir. In another separate incident, there has been an encounter going on between Indian security forces and pro-independence fighters, in which the two pro-independence fighters died during the clashes. And also, there is a news that's continuously there for the past 6 days that there is an encounter going near the line of control in Rajouri Poonch area of Indian-administered Kashmir, in which so far 9 Indian army personnel have been killed. 2 of them, their dead bodies were found today because they were missing from their headquarters. So these 2 were found today, their dead bodies.
An anti-imperialism resistance festival has kicked off in Britain. The 2-day event hopes to unite left-wing groups to create a new movement which are strong enough, or is strong enough, that should be, I'm sure, to fight back against growing censorship, capitalism, and a so-called witch hunt for the political left in Britain. Robert Carter reports from Nottingham.
A socialist fight back may be on the cards in British politics as left-wing anti-imperialist activists and parties gathered for a 2-day resistance festival in Nottingham. The organisers hope to unify the left following a mass purge of members from the UK Labour Party.
We think it's important to try and bring the left together, so we're bringing pressure groups, direct action groups, different political parties from the left together, with a view to trying to encourage all groups on the left to collaborate, because I think if we can achieve that, then I think we've got a real chance of breaking through and making a difference.
The anti-war struggle, imperialism and a political witch hunt of the left was among the many topics discussed.
Fighting against imperialism and fighting against apartheid should be is a crucial component of any social justice movement. But often what we've seen it in the Labour Party, is what gets put to the side time and time again. And in fact, people get crucified for even trying to actually, make a material difference and make a substantial fight against imperialism.
Organisers believe street action was key to forcing a change, but was also planning to hold a debate with members on starting a new political party too.
This festival may appear small time in comparison to the much larger political forces which dominate the scene here in the UK. However, a small acorn, if planted, could become a strong oak tree in the future. And that's very much what this movement hopes to achieve, by bringing together various factions which represent significantly popular views which the mainstream parties refuse to represent. Robert Carter, Nottingham.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
application on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hoped for nothing but bounty, and from whom I feared nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
In the limelight.
The world, especially the Muslim Ummah, is waiting for answers to these and other questions for the sake of the unity and stability of Afghanistan, which ought to be a sovereign, independent country with full security for the rights of all citizens instead of passing from one occupation to another occupation. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, International Staff Writer. This article is published under the heading, Another Terrorist Blast, as questions remain unanswered. Stay tuned for more. It seems terrorists are having a free reign in Afghanistan to kill people at will, especially those engaged in worship at mosques, without being arrested or brought to justice for their crimes against humanity. Recently, it was the dastardly bomb blast at Gozare Sayyid Abd Mosque in the city of Qunduz in eastern Afghanistan that martyred over 100 worshippers and left 150 others suffering various degrees of injuries. And this Friday, October 15th, the cowardly purveyors of Takfiri terrorism triggered blasts at the Imam Bargah Mosque in southern city of Kandahar to murder around 50 worshippers so far and injure scores of others. In both cases, the targets of terrorism were places of worshippers frequented by Muslims who are known as Shia for their adherence to the jurisprudential school of Prophet Muhammad's Immaculate Ahlul Bayt, a term used by the Noble Quran to describe the pristine purity of the Messenger of Mercy's immediate family. Incidentally, the latest blast occurred in the city where the leadership of the Taliban militia, which recently seized power in Kabul, is centered. We don't believe in the official version that the two blasts were suicide attacks because of the simple fact that terrorists are too timid by nature to blow themselves to bits. These so-called suicide attacks are actually remote control blasts in which some unsuspecting simpletons are used by terrorists to carry explosive kits or have explosive belts strapped around bodies on the pretext of medical vests for easing bodily pains. This tactic was widely practiced by the macabrely murderous Daesh terrorists with the full backing of their creators, the Americans and the Zionists in Syria and Iraq, until these cowards were decisively defeated and most of them transferred by the U.S. to Afghanistan in order to further destabilize the landlocked country that shares borders with Iran, Pakistan, China, and the Central Asian former Soviet republics of Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan. The questions that arise are, do the Taliban approve these acts of terrorism against Muslim compatriots belonging to another ethnic group and adhering to a different version of Islamic jurisprudence? If not, why did the ruling militia disarm and disband the Shia Hazara security guards who used to thoroughly check visitors in order to stop terrorist infiltrators? Also, why no action was taken against the Daesh terrorists following the Kunduz Mosque blast recently, despite the assurances of Taliban spokesperson Mujahid, who had promised to track down and punish the perpetrators? Now, after another act of terrorism, more loss of innocent life and desecration of the sanctity of yet another second place of worship, Zabiullah Mujahid has repeated the same phrase, "We condemn these attacks and the perpetrators would be brought to justice." Should Hazaras and the Shia citizens of Afghanistan, or for that matter other ethnic and religious groups such as the Tajiks, the Uzbeks, the Aymaks, the Sunni and Ismaili Muslims trust their new rulers, who are stubbornly sticking to a factional cabinet by refusing to form an all-inclusive government representing all Afghan people? The world, especially the Muslim Ummah, is waiting for answers to these and other questions for the sake of the unity and the stability of Afghanistan, which ought to be a sovereign, independent country with full security for the rights of all citizens, instead of passing from one occupation to another occupation.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
For the second time this year, the United States Congress voted to send Israel billions of dollars in military funding. Of course, there's nothing unusual about that specifically, but what is interesting is how progressives in Congress chose to coordinate their votes. On both occasions, members of the so-called squad, such as Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, either voted in favor of funding Israel or refused to take a concrete stance against it. So do these self-styled progressives actually support the Palestinian cause, or are they just all talk and trying to protect their careers and political ambitions in Washington, D.C.? We also take a look at the African Union. What is Israel doing in the African Union? Why was it granted observer status? And what is it trying to achieve? I speak to one of the lawyers who says that Israel has not earned an African welcome. He's part of a team that's leading efforts to revoke Israel's observer status from the African organization. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. We begin on September 20th. New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or AOC, proposes an amendment seeking to limit arms sales to Saudi Arabia and Israel. This came on the cusp of the third anniversary of the murder of Saudi journalist and dissident Jamal Khashoggi. AOC's amendment to block a sale to Israel worth over $700 million in Joint Direct Attack Munitions, or JDAM bombs, comes 4 months after Israel used these very munitions manufactured by Boeing to kill Palestinians in Gaza, most of them civilians. The offices of Al Jazeera and the Associated Press were also bombed during the Israeli onslaught against the besieged Gaza Strip back in May 2021. In light of these events, AOC's proposed amendments not only seemed quite sensible, but drew support from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and applause from human rights and pro-Palestinian advocates. This didn't, however, stop the Israeli ambassador to the U.S. from calling the congresswoman anti-Semitic for trying to restrict the sale of one weapon. The next day, another good move from progressives came when they nixed the Iron Dome provision from a government spending bill. The proposal would see another additional $1 billion sent to the Israelis to replenish their rocket intercepting system. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi likely added the Iron Dome provision to the government spending bill in an attempt to win over support from Republicans. This didn't work. And without Republican support, the bill was destined to fail. It could only pass by a simple majority if a handful of progressives in Congress agreed to it. They didn't. They said that if it's included in the bill, they won't vote for it. By acting as one collective bloc, they successfully removed the Iron Dome provision from the spending bill. Naturally, it's assumed that Israel would end up getting the money anyway, but this was the right thing to do, and it was in line with their stated principles of supporting human rights and standing up for Palestinians. For once, it seemed that progressives had finally gotten their act together. But unfortunately, this was short-lived. Just a few days later, funding for the Israeli Iron Dome was brought up for a separate vote in a standalone bill by House Appropriations Committee Chair Rosa DeLauro. Naturally, funding Israel is a much higher priority than raising the debt ceiling or making sure that the government doesn't shut down, so that had to come first. And as expected, the bill passed in a landslide, 420 to 9 votes. One Republican and 8 Democrats voted against it, including members of the squad, such as Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, and Cori Bush. However, the most famous of the group, AOC, mysteriously switched her vote from no to present at the last minute. AOC and her progressive colleagues apparently want to play both sides. She wants to appear like she opposes the establishment, but without actually doing anything to stand in the way. She wears a tax the rich dress while attending a $30,000 ticket event. She wears a Medicare for All mask while helping elect a House Speaker and a President who refused to support Medicare for All. And so here is AOC pretending to support Palestinians while refusing to take a clear stance against funding Israel. Well, AOC is, after all, not just a U.S. politician, but also a congresswoman from New York. Asked about her present vote on Mehdi Hassan's show, this is what she had to say.
Was it worth doing present? Because it didn't really satisfy anyone. The supporters of Israel are mad at you for not voting for it. Critics of Israel are mad at you for not voting against it. Do you regret that?
You know, it is something that I weigh, because there's always the macro and then there's the micro. And in the macro of narrative, of politics, of national impact, I probably should have just gone with my value. But in the macro, which would be to vote no. But in the micro, I do believe that this created a window in our community to be able to bring all folks to the table, because my great fear is that we are going to import the same sort of contention around this issue.
Well, I don't know about you, but that didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Macro, micro, what is she talking about? Are you against the violent illegal occupation of Palestine or not? It's a very simple question. Jamal Bowman, also a New York congressman and a so-called progressive, was also asked why he voted to fund the Iron Dome.
Your squad colleagues, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Ayanna Pressley, voted no. AOC controversially voted present. But you voted yes. How come?
It's important for me to make sure I represent everyone within my district, not just some people within my district. And this was an issue that was very important to many people in my district.
So when Jamal Bowman says that funding Israel's Iron Dome is representing his constituency, what does that mean exactly? Is he a congressman in Israel or in the United States? I think what AOC and Bowman are talking about are not their constituents. They're talking about their peers, their superiors, and special interests in D.C. You see, by not voting against Israel's Iron Dome specifically, they are showing, they are demonstrating that their criticism of Israel is all talk. It's just an act. They're telling the establishment and the Israelis, don't worry, because when it comes down to an actual vote, we're not going to stand in the way. And now pay attention, because this is the most important part. You need to understand what's going on here. When it came to funding the Iron Dome, you saw who voted no. Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, Cori Bush. But a few months prior, they did the exact opposite. In July, those same politicians voted yes to give Israel $3.8 billion in military funding. That bill in July barely passed. 217 in favor, 212 against. Neck and neck. And if they wanted to, they could have said, no, we're not voting for this. We are not giving Israel billions of dollars 8 weeks after they just butchered Palestinians in Gaza. But they did. They voted for it. And now when it comes to the Iron Dome, when they know that it's going to pass anyway, they vote no. And only then they vote no, because it's symbolic, so they can keep up the act. They can keep pretending that they are in support of Palestinians. This is all such an elaborate, deceitful act. And they don't just do this with funding Israel. They do this with the $15 minimum wage, with re-electing Nancy Pelosi. Every time there is a crucial vote, an ugly vote, some of the progressives will vote no, but just enough of them will vote yes to make sure that it passes. We already know that politics is theater. We already know that politics is a dirty game, but they are especially good at it. They're playing both sides, trying to keep their supporters, their constituents happy, and maintain their street credibility, while also making sure not to upset the establishment. That's the most important one. And what's interesting here is that there's an entire debate about the Iron Dome. You see, people on both sides of the aisle are saying, it's purely defensive. How can you vote no? Of course we should fund Israel's Iron Dome. It saves lives. Wow, that's great. If the Iron Dome is purely defensive, can the Palestinians have one too? Can Iran, Syria, or anyone else give the Palestinians billions of dollars to build anti-aircraft batteries? Do Palestinians also get to defend themselves from aerial attacks and rockets? Because if we look at the numbers, if we look at the facts, who is really in danger here? It's the Palestinians. The majority of casualties are always Palestinians and always Palestinian civilians. Just logically, it is the Palestinians who need protection the most. They need protection from Israeli jets who bomb them almost weekly. Who in the U.S. Congress is going to stand up and say that Palestinians also have a right to defend themselves? Are they not human beings? Are they not equals like you and I? Once again, you can clearly see this double standard, how they dehumanize Palestinians. They deprive them of a home, deprive them of a state, deprive them of dignity, and even of the basic right to self-defense. Every time an American European politician opens their mouth, all they talk about is Israel's right to defend itself. And they use this to justify mass murder of Palestinians, war crimes, bombing UN schools, bombing the press, bombing medics. So again, I ask you, what about Palestinians? Where is their right to self-defense? Some commentators and politicians even have the nerve to say that the Iron Dome saves Palestinian lives. Which Palestinians? The ones who are living under Israeli occupation? This is like saying that German bunkers and German anti-aircraft batteries in occupied France are saving the French from Allied bombs. This is how sick and twisted they sound. This is their logic. Israelis are the only ones who can defend themselves, and everyone else, they're not important. So in addition to scoring another $1 billion in funding from the U.S. Congress, on top of the $3.8 billion in July, Israel recently gained something else. Israel was granted observer status by the African Union back in July. Israel used to enjoy observer status at the Organization of African Unity, but this was replaced back in 2002 with the current African Union. And ever since, Israel has been desperately trying for almost 20 years now to get back in and regain its observer status. But what is Israel doing in the African Union? Why was it given observer status in the first place? And what are the objectives that it's trying to accomplish? Well, the team, comprised of international lawyers, have lodged a legal complaint in an attempt to get Israel's position at the African Union revoked. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me now is one of those lawyers leading the effort. His name is Stanley Cohen. He's an attorney and political activist and has represented many high-profile defendants such as Musa Abu Merzouk of Hamas. He's also been a consultant to numerous NGOs as well as to movements and governments throughout the Middle East, with Hamas and Hezbollah among them. Stanley Cohen, the one and only, thank you so much for joining me. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you for inviting me.
Stanley, if we could just start with the African Union. Why is Israel in the African Union? How did it get there? And could you maybe walk us through how it benefits from having observer status?
It remains to be seen. I mean, look, it's obvious that Israel has had a very close connection to various despotic regimes in the African Union since literally day one. It's provided arms to, you know, to the genocide in Rwanda. It supported South Africa to the very end. They had a relationship involving resources for Israel's nuclear program in exchange for Israel helping to develop South Africa's. It's been involved in Kenya, it's been involved in Angola, it's been involved, you name it. Israel's footprint is heavy, is long, is deep in Africa, and as is typical for Israel, it's very ugly, it's very violent, it's very despotic, it's very corrupt. But it has tried for over 20 years to get the observer status, and it has failed on each occasion. And what it did this time, and it remains to be seen whether we will be able to flesh out in full how it accomplished it, it waited until the legislative body of the African Union was in suspension, was not meeting, was not sitting, and it brokered some sort of deal with the committee, the executive committee that deals with situations while they're not actively involved. It, who knows, bribery, weapons, resources, contracts, relationships. They reached out and they got it. Now, what does it get? It furthers the Israeli agenda of like the Abraham Accords, of saying we're good people, we're liking to build, we want to build bridges and open doors. We're getting bad press. We're not the despotic, horrible, nightmare, genocidal maniacs the world correctly describes them as. It's got billions of dollars worth of weapons contracts in Africa. Its private quote unquote industry has billions of dollars worth of contracts for natural resources. The connectivity between the northern part of Africa, which is part of the Middle East, and the west and the east and the southern tier. What's most perverse about this process is it's a reintroduction, it's a reaffirmation, it's a reinflammation of the very European colonial, the very white European colonial project that subjugated the African continent for 150 years. This provides Israel with an opportunity to work on its agenda, to work on its position and presence, to get access to information, to participate in discussions, to be able to introduce into the body politic at the commission or at the union their view, their discussion, their approach towards world problems, world issues. It allows them to build in a stronger safety net in the United Nations, whether it's in the General Assembly, where there can easily now be a dozen, 15 states from the African continent that can support it and be opposed to Africa, to General Assembly votes against it. It builds in further support in the Security Council where it really doesn't need it. So on so many levels, this is a big win for Israel and a terrible loss for 1.4 billion members of the African continent.
You just mentioned some of the things that you also wrote about in Counterpunch. For example, Israel being able to garner support from other nations at the UN the next time that it bombs Gaza. Or you mentioned the extraction industrial complex, arms sales. Could you maybe just elaborate a bit more on these things and how Israel would benefit from having stronger ties with African nations in this regard?
Sure. Israel is always looking to engender, to develop new support for cover. New states, especially states of color, especially states that traditionally one would think would be opposed because they have a history of genocide, of European colonial projects. So Israel is looking to develop this cheering section, this rubber stamp, this group, particularly in the African continent, a continent of people of color, black women and men largely, certainly all of color, who supports them. So that when the debate develops about Israeli racism, about its supremacist policies, about its hatred towards people of color, about its support for European colonial projects, about it being one, it gets to point to Africa. And it gets to say, what are you talking about? We've got the support of the African Union. When it comes down to key votes over whether a committee in the United Nations will go one way or another way in terms of the potential sanctions, in terms of suspending Israel's rights or ability to continue in a particular committee, they can look to Africa. This is all part of the grand Israeli propaganda scheme, but yet on the other hand, it also provides some cover for those African nations, individual African nations that have been getting political heat and flashback for the close economic relationship with Israel. So it furthers the ability of Israel to spend, to sell billions and more. We now know, recently it's been exposed that Israel has this enormous surveillance technology that it's been selling to African states, to despotic regimes. We know it provides a launch pad to push back against South Africa and other historically independent states that have fought against the kind of apartheid, the kind of racism, the kind of hate, the kind of European colonial project that is Israel. So from a standpoint of propaganda, it's a win. From a standpoint of building in support for its economic, its military, and its political agenda, it's a win. And from the standpoint of garnering support from people of color, from a continent of color, the next time it knocks over schools, it destroys residential towers, it attacks hospitals in Gaza, it can look and say, what are you talking about? It's an extension. It's everything the Abraham Accords introduced but really couldn't produce.
Stanley, you yourself and a team of international lawyers, you've gotten together to try and revoke Israel's observer status. Could you tell us a bit more about how you hope to achieve this and how you're working to combat this?
Sure. It's part of a broader strategy. You have the activity that's underway in the African Union itself, where there's some two dozen states are now demanding a full discussion, debate, exchange when the African Union comes together again in another week, in less than a week. It is also part of challenges to Israel in various states in Africa under universal jurisdiction where there are lawsuits for crimes against humanity and for war crimes, and where Israeli political leaders and military leaders can't travel lest they be possibly arrested or lest property be seized. Our strategy itself is to bring before the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, which is an overseeing entity, an organization which was designed under the African Union and its predecessor to act as a referee, to act as a board of oversight, to deal with conflicts within the African Union, to provide a vehicle to challenge activities of one state versus another. For example, in 2014, I was part of a team of lawyers that brought an action in the African Union against Egypt for its refusal during the Israeli attack to open the Rafah border to let refugees under siege and under slaughter escape into Egypt. So it is an instrument that provides binding law, which serves as a mediator or conflict resolver, but it also provides advisory opinions. And at this point, we're seeking what amounts to an advisory opinion. We have two entities, one a national media, an international media outlet that's bottomed largely in the African continent, and two, we have a Palestinian solidarity organization in South Africa that are actually our clients. They're the complainants. They approached us and said, look, we have standing because we're recognized by the commission to bring an action that, among other things, that we're now seeking is one discovery, which says, okay, we want the documents, we want the information, we want depositions, we want discussions, we want to interview, we want to question those people that played a role in this decision making so that the truth is fleshed out. We're seeking oral argument, and we're inviting Israel to participate in oral argument. They'll never do it. What Israel will say is, we can't do that because it's recognizing its jurisdiction. So we have affirmatively stated, we will not argue later if you join an oral argument that you're ceding jurisdiction. So they can't use that as an excuse. My understanding is we're now up to about 24 members of the African Union of the 54 or 55 states, which means we don't need that many more to reverse the decision legislatively, and I would hope that may happen. We're in communication with various states and organizations within the African Union itself about this. We are planning to submit a supplemental application for relief in the next week to 2 weeks. Now that we have more information about how this happened, who brought it about, and why, we're going to name particular individuals and seek depositions from them rather than generic requests. And by the way, we have a dozen or so first-party affidavits, complaints, declarations from victims of the most recent Israeli assault, the murder, the bombing, and destruction in Gaza just this past May. So our position is, in 2021, this is an obscenity. In 2021, when most of the world with open eyes and good heart looks at what's going on in Palestine and says, apartheid, 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 hatred, war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, you cannot, as a continent that has withstood 150 years of even worse conduct, or not that worse, but the same kind of European colonial violence, apartheid, hatred, resource theft, you cannot welcome Israel. You cannot give a privilege to a war criminal. That's the strategy.
Israel's admission to the African Union is a gross perversion of the organization itself and an attempt to legitimize a white European colonial project, which is the antithesis of what most African and post-colonial countries stand for. It's an attempt to legitimize the occupation and portray it as some innocent nation state while actively denying Palestinians the very same. Israel thinks that by normalizing ties with Arab countries through the Abraham Accords or joining the African Union, even just as an observer, that it can rebrand itself as some regular nation instead of what it is, a colonial settler project. And then make everyone forget about the war crimes, the apartheid, the occupation. Where is the Palestinian state? Why don't the Palestinians get to join the African Union? Where is their self-determination? And at the same time, over in the U.S. Congress, you have supposed allies of Palestine who turn out to be all talk and no action. You know, once upon a time, a certain young woman of color who was running for Congress in New York said, so what if you're a one-term Congress member? You can make 10 years worth of change in one term if you're not afraid. Well, where is that Congresswoman today? Perhaps she and her colleagues are indeed too afraid to make any change now that they're in office. You see, by funding Israel and refusing to take a clear stance against arming the occupation, they have shown that their political career and ambitions far outweigh their empathy for Palestinians. At the end of the day, we are talking about U.S. politicians. Women of color or not, they're U.S. politicians. And you cannot make it in D.C. politics without playing dirty. These so-called progressives who claim to support Palestine and claim that their politics are rooted in human rights, they voted to give Israel billions of dollars. They voted to fund the occupation. They gave Israel money to continue occupying and bombing Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, almost on a weekly basis, on a daily basis. This is what they have funded. This is the blood on their hands. And if you want to go and listen to their Twitter posts and their Instagram lives, be my guest. But look at their voting record. Look at how they act, and you will know them by their votes. Once again, you see the double standard of how only Israelis have the right to a state, only Israelis have the right to self-defense, only Israelis have the right to live in peace and security, and the Palestinians? Nothing. They're just terrorists, according to the media and Western politicians. They want to make the oppressor look like a victim, and the victim look like an oppressor for daring, for the crime of resisting a foreign military occupation. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight.
United Nations Human Rights Council action silences Yemeni victims of human rights abuses. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Katie Kelly, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Did the United Nations Just Abandon Yemen? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Monday, October 11th, marked the official closure of the UN Group of Eminent Experts on Yemen, also known as the Group of Experts for GEE. For nearly 4 years, this investigative group examined alleged human rights abuses suffered by Yemenis whose basic rights to food, shelter, safety, healthcare, and education were horribly violated, all while they were bludgeoned by Saudi and U.S. airstrikes, drone attacks, and constant warfare since 2014. The GEE wrote in a statement the day after the UN Human Rights Council refused to extend a mandate for continuation of the group's work. This is a major setback for all victims who have suffered serious violations during the armed conflict. The council appears to be abandoning the people of Yemen, the statement says, adding that victims of this tragic armed conflict should not be silenced by the decision of a few states. Prior to the vote, there were indications that Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as Bahrain, which sits on the UN Human Rights Council, had increased lobbying efforts worldwide in a bid to do away with the group of experts. Actions of the Saudi-led coalition waging war against Yemen had been examined and reported on by the group of experts. Last year, the Saudi bid for a seat on the Human Rights Council was rejected, but Bahrain serves as its proxy. Bahrain is a notorious human rights violator and a staunch member of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia-led coalition, which buys billions of dollars worth of weaponry from the U.S. regime and other countries to bomb Yemen's infrastructure, kill civilians, and displace millions of people. The group of experts was mandated to investigate violations committed by all warring parties. The group of experts' mission has come to an end, but the fear and intimidation faced by Yemeni victims and witnesses continues. M. Watana for Human Rights, an independent Yemeni organization established in 2007, advocates for human rights by reporting on issues such as the torture of detainees, grossly unfair trials, patterns of injustice, and starvation by warfare through the destruction of farms and water sources. M. Watana had hoped the UN Human Rights Council would grant the group of experts a multi-year extension. Members of N. Watana fear their voice will be silenced within the United Nations if the Human Rights Council's decision is an indicator of how much the Council cares about Yemenis. The GEE is the only independent and